Well, good morning, brethren. Well, I spent my early college years pursuing a degree in creative writing with a poetry emphasis. I know I might not look like somebody that go after poetry, but in Colorado we're very secure with our masculinity. We're poets, flower arrangers, and even men that will sing the YMCA song in public. One of my favorite 20th century poets, as I was studying, is by the name of William Carlos Williams. And I want to read a poem he wrote, and it's called The Red Wheelbarrow, and it's probably one of his best known and most evaluated poems. And it goes like this. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow, glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. Oh, that's it. I like short poems. Well, that might not sound like it, but that's actually an 8-line poem. And Williams was not known for long, elaborate, rhyming poems, but for very succinct, simple ones like that. He used a lot of style that you might see in haiku poems, for instance. Well, who remembers what that poem was about? A red wheelbarrow? Chickens? Maybe rainwater? You know, those concepts weren't hard to visualize. You know, unless I'm mistaken, you know, none of us here have literary critics as our resume titles. And thus I'm sure, you know, not sure that any of you could really understand the full meaning of that short poem. You know, so I will read one literary critic's interpretation of what this poem really meant, what we didn't get out of that very simple. And it is quite long and for that specific purpose. And jumping into it, it's still, what is most intriguing is that the poem expresses a romantic notion that at the same time is purged of sentimentality. One might go so far as to say that The Red Wheelbarrow is an anti-poem, or a poem attempting to be not so much a poem, but a hard object glazed with poetry. In short, an ingeniously simple poem like The Red Wheelbarrow, it is necessary not only to describe what the poem does, but what it does not do. Or in other words, what makes it an anti-poem. Even so, Williams, the writer, conceives The Red Wheelbarrow as a poem, and Williams calls himself a poet, having worked most of his life writing poetry and theorizing about it. So then, what is this poem about? Perhaps it is a contrast between shiny, metallic red and full, feathery white? Between a cultural artifact and natural animals? Between a thing that must be moved next to beings that move themselves? Between something that must be fed or loaded next to creatures who feed themselves? Do you take anything different from this poem now? Does it mean something more to you after having heard that? Or has your initial interpretation changed because you heard an expert explain what that poem means? Well, now I want to read a little bit more towards the origin of that poem and what the poet was actually doing. It says, Williams was a pediatrician, which means he probably did not have time to study literature formally. So it follows that he would profess a fondness for poetry composed of the immediately observable world. And while caring for a sick child at that child's home, Williams wrote the Red Wheelbarrow in less than 5 minutes while observing the scene out of the window. However, the claim that so much depends on this wheelbarrow is quite accurate. On a farm, a wheelbarrow is used for a number of important farm chores, moving tools from the barn to the house and back, transporting feed for the cows and chickens, carrying seeds for planting, and then produce to the house for harvest. So that statement, the beginning one, is true. On a farm, a lot does depend on being able to cart around various items. And, of course, being able to move these items easily, you know, for one's livelihood as a farmer, is facilitated. Well, you know, it seems that that critic that I read earlier is more full of hot air than real knowledge of what that poem was really talking about. You know, it's not to say Williams wasn't trying to make statements about other cultural ideals, and that's quite the norm in most writing to have underlying ideas, but sometimes a red wheelbarrow is just that, a red wheelbarrow. You know, this might be an understatement, But there are many different interpretations and critics, or literary critics, of what the Bible quite plainly tells us and what quite plainly says. In fact, interpretations have been so different, so divisive, that religions have started, religions have been divided, and people have been persecuted. Whole religions have been persecuted because of those different interpretations and those different experts that told people what actually the Bible said. Well, but isn't the Bible, this book that we all probably have in our laps, isn't that easy to understand? You know, wouldn't God have wanted it as such? Well, if you listen to experts, they might actually tell you no. You might be told that only with proper schooling, only with, you know, certain understanding, can you really interpret what the Bible really means for mankind. Now, there is some truth to that statement I just made, but it's not the schooling of mankind that leads us to a true and good understanding of the Bible. We all here know quite well that it's God's Spirit that truly opens our minds up and gives us real biblical understanding. Well, much like the interpretation of the poem I read earlier, you know, focusing heavily on biblical interpretation and what others might tell you the Bible means, instead of simply reading the Bible, can lead to confusion and not to understanding. You know, I don't mean to completely discount some of the texts that we can pick up about the Bible that explain some of the very specific things more detail, because there can be a lot to be gleaned from these works. But only if you keep them in perspective. Only if you don't rely on them as your crutch. You know, my grandfather in his life was a voracious reader. And he gave some good points for me to learn how to read other people's writings. You know, if a man worked on a John Deere tractor all of his life and wrote a book explaining how to service those tractors, it'd be safe to assume that the knowledge he was imparting was of great value. You could take what he had to say and work on John Deere tractors. But when he delved into his belief that John Deere tractors were so holy that they were brought to here by aliens, the same ones that built the pyramids, you'd have to step back a little bit and realize, you know, now he's interjecting opinion and not fact. You know, everybody, when they write, interjects their own opinions, even while putting forth very useful facts. And the key to reading is being able to sift the facts from the opinions. Or one might put it in a biblical sense, the wheat from the chaff. Well, what about this Bible? You know, it was written, after all, by many different men, but with many different opinions. And the experts, as you sometimes can find, will argue that all those interpretations of the Bible, even the ones that, you know, there's some that even contradict each other, and that, you know, you can't really take it as a whole. Well, it is true, as I said, that the Bible is made up by many different writers, but the key to understanding what all those writers have brought to us hinges on two fundamental concepts. One, the reader needs the Spirit of God to interpret. And two, the writers were inspired by that Spirit of God. Without those two keys, most importantly the first, the Bible is nothing more than a jumbled mess of stories to most readers. And I have to qualify that the Bible is not inherently misleading. It's not inherently unapproachable. It's because of mankind's rebellion against God and their rejection of him that it is understandable or misinterpreted. If you will, turn with me to Isaiah 44. Isaiah 44, and I will begin in verse 9. Those who make an image, all of them are useless. And their precious things shall not profit. They are their own witnesses. They neither see nor know, that they may be ashamed. And skipping over to verse 13, the craftsman stretches out his rule, He marks one out with chalk. He fashions it with a plane. He marks it out with a compass and makes it like the figure of a man, according to the beauty of a man, that it may remain in the house. Verse 14, he cuts down cedars for himself and takes the cypress and the oak. He secures it for himself among the trees of the forest. He plants a pine, and the rain nourishes it. Then it shall be for a man to burn, and he will take some of it and warm himself. Yes, he kindles it and bakes bread. Indeed, he makes a god and worships it. He makes a carved image and falls down to it. He burns half of it in the fire. With this half he eats meat. He roasts the roast and is satisfied. He even warms himself and says, "Ah, I am warm. I have seen the fire." And the rest of it he makes into a god, his carved image. He falls down before it and worships it, prays to it and says, "Deliver me, for you are my God." And verse 18, they do not know nor understand, for he has shut their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so that they cannot understand. And no one considers in his heart, nor is there knowledge, nor understanding to say, "I have burned half of it in the fire. Yes, I have also baked bread on its coals. I have roasted meat and eaten it. And shall I make the rest of it into an abomination? Shall I fall down before a block of wood?" He feeds on ashes, and a deceived heart has turned him aside. He cannot deliver his soul, nor say, "Is there not a lie in my right hand?" And that whole discourse is talking about how maybe far out of the way mankind will go to not follow God, to follow his own idea of what God is. You know, it's impossible to fully understand God without his Spirit residing within us. You know, most here have probably discussed the Bible with non-converted friends or family. How did that go for you? Did you get your point across very well? You know, if you were able to make your point and help that person truly understand a particular passage at any point, you know, reading it over and slowly and loudly, well, most likely not. No matter how loud, no matter forceful you read very plain scriptures, people without God's Spirit cannot understand sometimes, most of the time. So how can we know and be assured that we have the knowledge through the Spirit of God to correctly read and understand our Bible? I want to use an analogy to better visualize this question and concept. And it's this: belief in God, understanding God, and ultimately submitting ourselves to God is much like skydiving or parachuting. And when we are born, we are, in essence, pushed out of an airplane. And sin, just like gravity, is pulling us to the same eventual resolution: death, or, for the case of a parachuter, the hard surface of the planet. You know, somewhere during that fall that we all are making, we have to pull the ripcord for our parachute, or come to understand and rely on God at some point in our lives. Because if we do neither, there is one very particular ending that we are all guaranteed to meet with: the ground, or ultimately death. You know, many of the same pitfalls that endanger skydivers can also endanger our spiritual life as well. And the first of these is this: you must pull and deploy your chute before hitting the ground. That seems very obvious. Most repeating skydivers would agree 100% with me on that importance. Well, you know, the emphasis here should be on deploying, not just, you know, be on deploying it, not just pulling the ripcord. You know, while you might have successfully pulled your cord 5 seconds before hitting the ground, the previous 5 minutes of traveling at terminal velocity, which is near 200 miles an hour, doesn't disappear. You know, spiritually, God is not calling into his family people who, on their, in essence, deathbeds, confess to him. You know, he is not looking for a family full of last-minute prayers and hopes that they can be redeemed and forgiven a few seconds before they die. And another idea is this: the ripcord doesn't pull itself. Again, that's a very obvious observation, and one in which, again, most repeat skydivers that have gone more than once will agree with. And what about us spiritually speaking? You know, God has provided a means for us to escape the penalties of death, but we, as Mr. Link mentioned in his sermon, must answer that knocking at the door and let God in. You know, pulling that spiritual ripcord must be paramount to all of our spiritual lives. If you will, turn with me back to Proverbs 2. We can read on how important this knowledge is for us. Proverbs 2. Proverbs 2 and verse, starting in verse 1. My son, if you receive my words and treasure my commands within you, so that you incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding, yes, if you cry out for discernment and lift up your voice for understanding, do you seek her as silver and search for her as for hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom from his mouth. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk uprightly. He guards the paths of justice and preserves the way of his saints. Then you will understand righteousness and justice, equity and every good path. You know, if we treasure God's interaction in our lives, we will, as it says in verse 9, find a good path. You know, no matter, another similarity we have is this with skydivers. No matter how much you try to slow yourself down, how much you try to control your descent, whether it's through some weird Superman or Batman moves. I thought I'd get a little, the kids would at least look up at me. Whenever they hear that, they do. But no matter whatever moves you may do, you will not be able to safely land by yourself. You know, skydivers, as you see, use suits that help them. They give them webbing between their fingers and their arms to help them control their descent in some ways and to perform acrobatics. You know, they can also control their movement to land on certain targets to a degree. But all of them, at some point, every skydiver deploys a parachute before coming to a safe stop on the ground. And likewise, spiritually, we must put away attempts to save ourselves and instead rely on God to save us. 2 Corinthians, if you will turn there, talks about this concept. 2 Corinthians and verse and chapter 1, if you turn. Second Corinthians 1, starting in verse 9. Yes, we had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a death, and does deliver us, in whom we trust that he will still deliver us. In verse 11, you also, helping together in prayer for us, that thanks may be given for many persons, on our behalf for the gift granted to us through many. Another similarity is this. Focusing too much on others instead of your own descent can lead to entanglements and can jeopardize not only your safety, but the safety of those around you. In August of this year, the world record was set as 108 skydivers linked up in midair. Now, quote an article talking about this. It said, hitting speeds of up to 180 miles per hour after they jumped from 18,000 feet, the skydivers, had 40 seconds to free fall to find each other and to complete their formation. Each skydiver then only had a second after breaking away from that group before preparing for a safe touchdown at around 7,000 feet. Once complete, it was the largest number of skydivers to link up while falling head first. And the picture of it were quite amazing. And they said, even with all of that, there were still two people that didn't completely make the cut, that weren't able to connect with everybody. You know, in order for this feat to complete, everybody, every last one of those skydivers, had to know exactly what their role was and stick to that plan. There was no room for error. You know, had one of those skydivers not been focused on their position, had they bumped into that one of those forming groups, the entire formation would have been in jeopardy. You know, for those reasons, only expert skydivers were chosen for that jump. And only after many practice jumps and many rehearsals did they attempt to make that world record. Well, spiritually, we haven't been given one big skydiving jump in our lives. There aren't redos once we jump out of this plane. And we are aiming, if we are here today, if we have brought into ourselves God's Spirit, we are aiming for the first resurrection, not the second or third. So we must make this jump count. One danger then for us in this jump we're making is becoming entangled up with other jumpers and spinning out of control. You know, 1 Corinthians, if you'll turn there, talks a little bit about this concept. First Corinthians 5. First Corinthians 5 and starting in verse 9. I wrote to you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people. Yet I certainly did not mean with the sexually immoral people of this world, or with the covetous, or extortioners, or idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world. But now I have written to you not to keep company with anyone named a brother who is sexually immoral or covetous or an idolater or a reviler or a drunkard or an extortioner, not even to eat with such a person. For what have I to do with judging those also who are on the outside? Do you not judge those who are on the inside? But those who are outside God judges. Therefore, put away from yourselves an evil person. Skipping over to 1 Corinthians 15. 1 Corinthians 15 and in verse 33. Do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits. Awake to righteousness and do not sin, for some do not have the knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame. Bad habits while skydiving can cause death. You don't want to hang around somebody that is not performing good habits while doing such a death-defying event. Brethren, Satan's way of life, his world, as we've heard, can be exemplified by our plummet towards the ground, towards death. And while we are falling at nearly 200 miles an hour, our environment is quite confusing. The rushing wind, the inability to communicate normally, all make up for a very inhospitable surrounding. And God alone has the ability to stop our plunge. And when the parachute He provides us is deployed, our situation instantly becomes calmer. We are no longer living in a confused state, but we now have the ability to assess our surroundings with much greater understanding, much greater calmness. Well, I guess the big question that we must ask ourselves is this. You know, are we plummeting toward the ground, or are we slowly floating down towards it? You know, are we in a state of confusion, or are we in a state of understanding? Satan, through his deception, can make this a state of confusion. You know, so Satan can make what he provides, what he is doing, a very similar to true state of understanding. But the reality is no different than the analogy of the skydiver, with what Satan puts forth and what God's true understanding gives us, is that Satan's state quickly is leading us to death. Well, how can we prove then? How can we know for a fact what state we are all currently in? I assume that we all would make an assumption that we are trying to reach a state of understanding, that we are trying to reach that calm state. But as a general rule of thumb, I would say, assume you are not, and continually strive to be in a state of understanding. You know, God is inherently not hard to understand, assuming, and that's the big but here, assuming you have His Spirit guiding you. A little bit further in Corinthians, I'll have us turn back to Corinthians 1. This will prove that it doesn't take experts to have this understanding. Corinthians 1 and verse 26. Corinthians 1 and verse 26. Or 1 Corinthians, I'm sorry. For you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise according to the flesh, that not many mighty, not many noble, are called. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. And the base things of the world and the things which are despised God has chosen, and the things which are not to bring to nothing the things that are, that no flesh should glory in His presence. You know, Christ didn't simply call the religious experts of His time to follow after Him as a soul group. He called fishermen to be His disciples, and He attracted the lowest members of society to be His followers, people that were despised by the religious experts. If you will, turn with me back to Mark 4. I'll look at some parables that Christ gave. Mark 4, starting in verse 9. And He said to them, "He who hears has ears to hear, let him hear." But when He was alone, those around Him with the 12 asked Him about the parable. And He said to them, "To you it has been given to know the mystery of the kingdom of God, but to those who are outside, all things come in parables. So that, seeing they may see and not perceive, and hearing they may hear and not understand, lest they should turn, and their sins be forgiven them." And He said to them, "Do you not understand this parable? How then will you understand all of the parables?" You know, to steal some of the comedian Jeff Foxworthy's comic lines, we could ask, "Do you understand Christ's parables?" as a proof to know if we have this understanding. If you do, then you might be in a state of understanding. If you will, turn with me over to Colossians 2 for another proof. Colossians 2, and starting in verse 1. "For I want you to know what a great conflict I have for you and those in Laodicea, and for as many as have not seen my face in the flesh, that their hearts may be encouraged, being knit together in love and attaining to all the riches in the full assurance of understanding, to the knowledge of the mystery of God, both of the Father and of Christ." And verse 3, "in whom are hidden all of the treasures of wisdom and knowledge." So how do we treat that knowledge of God? Do we treat the knowledge of God like a treasure? If you do, then you might be in a state of understanding. Looking back in Luke 5, to see the company that Christ kept as another proof to our understanding. Luke 5 and verse 27. After these things, he went out and saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax office, and he said to him, "Follow me." So he left all, rose up, and followed him. Then Levi gave him a great feast in his own house, and there were a great number of tax collectors and others who sat down with them. And their scribes and the Pharisees complained against his disciples, saying, "Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?" You know, are we of the crowd that Christ kept? If we are, then there's a good chance we are in a state of understanding. And to further exemplify that, turn to 1 John 4. We can see how we treat those that we're keeping fellowship with. 1 John 4. In verse 17, love has been perfected among us in this, that we may have boldness in the day of judgment, because as he is, so are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves torment. But he who fears has not been made perfect in love. We love him because he first loved us. If someone says, "I love God," and hates his brother, he is a liar, for he does not love his brother whom he has seen. For if he does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? And this commandment we have from him, that he who loves God must love his brother also. So how do you love the crowd that Christ has called? If you love them, then you might be in a state of understanding. Well, there's probably many more questions like this that we could ask ourselves. But even with those four, it gives us a good litmus test. And that test doesn't take a four-year religious degree to interpret, to ask ourselves. You know, recently I have had a discourse with a teacher that initially was very curious about my religious beliefs, and he was also a practicing and schooled, as he would say, an expert minister. Well, after some discussions, over a few weeks, he told me in so many words that he really couldn't have a deep and meaningful religious discussion with me because I didn't have the same background as him. And he was referring to his four-year religious degree and his deep understanding of the church fathers and some of the deeper issues of God that I just couldn't understand of not having that degree. And his assumption was this, that without an understanding of all of the church fathers, and by church fathers I mean those that came after the biblical account, my literal interpretation of the Bible was just simply a little bit flawed. You know, he asked the last time we talked some somewhat loaded questions and almost chuckled at one of my answers, and said almost literally, like Paul was speaking to a specific time period, "Those things don't apply to us today." Well, you know, as my teacher whizzes by me at terminal velocity and shouts back, "I'm winning! I'm going to beat you!" I can safely peer down at him in my slow-moving, controlled descent towards the ground and respond, "Yes, yes, you are." That wouldn't be nice, I guess, but... Well, as confusing and convoluted as the world's religions have made God out to be, the simplistic version can also be summed up like this. God is the Father. His Son, a separate being, became fully human and died for us. We can be brothers and sisters to the Christ and become an eternal family. You know, that simplistic description, as some may call it, of how I observe the Bible took me less than 5 minutes to come up with. You know, Bible critics have spent several thousand years without the help of God's Spirit, as an important caveat, and can't even come up with that, those four or those three simple little lines. That does not stop the flow of book after book of convoluted arguments discussing the topic of the Bible. You know, brethren, we have been given a treasure, and that treasure is God's Spirit. It gives us understanding, and it wipes away the confusion of this world. And God, the beauty of it, God pours that understanding out on us abundantly. And He pours it out on the simple and the base things of this world, in order, as we read earlier, to confound the mighty things, and to prove that nothing comes from us, that all wisdom comes from God. So Christ said, or as He said in Luke, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be." So brethren, let's make sure our hearts are continually recognizing where the true treasure lies.